I'm Tammy Vindange, your host for Executive with a Cause. Today on the show, I welcome Susan Davidson, the CEO of the Australian Diabetes Educators Association. Today, we're going to chat about the good, bad, and hard things about running a not-for-profit. Susan, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tammy.
We met around Christmas time last year at an association's forum event, and we started talking about your organization and the operations around it. And I was fascinated by the way you actually talked about it in such an operational way, because I find that most CEOs are very marketing and sales focused, that they don't see it at that level. And so when I spoke to you, I said, I have to have you on my show. And thank you for saying yes.
Yeah, that's my pleasure. I'm glad to be here. Thanks, Tammy.
So for people that are not familiar with your organization, can you tell us more about it?
So the Australian Diabetes Educators Association is a member-based organization. We're the peak body for credentialed diabetes educators in Australia. So credentialed diabetes educators are health professionals. They could be nurses, podiatrists, physiotherapists, exercise physiologists, etc., dietitians, who have done additional qualifications, postgraduate study specifically in diabetes, and had a minimum level of practice in diabetes education and care before they can qualify as a credentialed diabetes educator. And as a peak body, we, of course, look after our members. We provide education and so on to them, conferences, online education, webinars, podcasts, you know, various member services. But we also have a very strong focus on people with diabetes, because that's ultimately who we're here to serve. And we work closely with government and other peak organisations to make sure that people with diabetes do actually get the best healthcare possible.
Okay. So how many members do you have?
We have nearly 2,500 members.
Okay. 2,500. And are there different levels of membership?
Yes, we allow people to join the organisation who are not credentialed diabetes educators, but they have an interest in diabetes education and care. And people who are wanting to become credentialed diabetes educators must be a member at an associate level. Once they're qualified, they can become a credentialed diabetes educator and a full member.
And your organisation does the accreditation?
We do the accreditation. We're a self-regulated profession. Uh-huh. Yes, we do the accreditation and provide further education. We endorse continuing professional development, whether it's provided by us or others. So we work very collaboratively with other organisations.
Okay. It's interesting that when you're talking about your mission, I noticed that you used to work for Diabetes Australia. Can you tell us what the difference is between the two organizations?
Yes, Diabetes Australia is a much larger organization than ours, and it's actually the organization, what you might call the consumer peak body, the organization that advocates for people with diabetes. So it doesn't include the health professionals, but of course they would liaise closely with us. We would provide medical, scientific and education advice. We've always been very closely associated with Diabetes Australia, but quite independent organisations.
Mm. So when did the educators part of the organisation begin? Because it seems like oftentimes a larger membership organisations or larger charities of such will often embrace all aspects of it. So there was obviously a weak spot that somebody said we need to do something different.
Yes, correct. So the consumer diabetes organisations actually started as state-based organisations. Diabetes Victoria is about to celebrate its 70th anniversary. So it's been around for a long while. So the state organisations established over time in each of the states and territories, and in the mid-80s there were discussions about establishing a national diabetes services scheme, which is in Australia called the NDSS. And the reason for establishing that was that people with type 1 diabetes require, at that time, the only way to manage their insulin, diabetes was to provide themselves with insulin injections regularly during the day. And it's very expensive. And there are a lot of other costs associated with diabetes, as you can imagine. It's a serious medical condition. So there was a lot of advocacy that I think needles had become free for drug users around that time. And people with diabetes said, hey, hang on, we have to use these to live. You know, why aren't we getting subsidised access? So that was the reason for forming the National Diabetes Services Scheme. So the government agreed to fund that, and they preferred to work with a national body rather than, you know, all the different state organisations. So they said, we'll do this with you, but we need a national body. So the state bodies essentially said, okay, let's set up a national body, which was called Diabetes Australia, to administer that scheme. It started off, I think, with about 30,000 people, and now there are nearly 1.5 million people registered with that. So yeah, that's how the National Diabetes Services Scheme came about and how Diabetes Australia was formed. So yes, the state consumer bodies came first, Diabetes Australia followed, and around that same time that Diabetes Australia was formed, it was mainly nurses at that time dealing with people with diabetes, mainly in hospitals, and it was becoming more complex, you know, more was being learned about it and the management of it. And so they said, well, we actually need a specialised profession. You know, there are specialist skills and knowledge, and we need to make sure these people are managed well, because the consequences of diabetes can be devastating if they're not managed well.
One of my best mates has type 1 diabetes, and I've done sport with her for many, many years. So I'm probably more familiar than others with at least the type 1 version. It's interesting to me that the Diabetes Australia itself is still, though, you know, although consumer focused, it looks like it. Well, in Australia, we also have the National Disability Insurance Scheme, which supports those that need additional support in other ways. And I'm sure a lot of people hearing this will be more familiar with that one. In the NDSS case, I think you were in charge of running that program.
Yes, I managed that for over 10 years, that program. It's, as I said, a government-funded scheme. It grew. So initially it was just about free needles, syringes, that sort of thing for people with type 1 diabetes, but it grew to be bigger than that. So there was a realisation as time went on that people with diabetes needed information, that they needed to be aware of the support they could get. So the scheme grew to provide other services. There's a national helpline for people with diabetes. There are various information booklets that go out, you know, when you're first diagnosed, to give you information about what's out there to support you and the key things, you know, to sort of look out for and consider, and a whole lot of other educational materials produced through the National Diabetes Services Scheme.
So, Susan, were you there? Did you actually start the scheme? Did you actually set that up?
No. I didn't join until I joined Diabetes Australia in 2007, and I wasn't initially managing the National Diabetes Services Scheme. I took that over in 2009. So, no, I wasn't there at the start. It was set up in the mid-80s.
And how did you get involved in the not-for-profit sector?
Well, a bit of a journey. So I actually studied economics in my first degree, and I worked for what is now EY. So a few firms. I worked for a little firm that merged with another firm that merged with another firm and ended up working for EY. And I was there for quite some time, and I really enjoyed it. It was very much a young person's profession. I learned a lot about business. I learned a lot about professional standards and, you know, that sort of thing, very good training. But I guess I developed an interest in health, and that was really came about because of myself and my children. So I ended up with some chemical poisoning, and my children had allergies, quite severe allergies, which we couldn't manage. So I got quite an interest in health, exploring, you know, how do we deal with these things. So I studied health science. I left economics and EY, and I studied health science, and slowly sort of moved into the health field. And it was as a result of that that I ended up working with Diabetes Australia. I had a particular interest in diabetes and how to assist people to live as healthily as possible with it, because and there's lots of misconceptions about diabetes. So I might just say that now. A lot of people think if you overeat, or obese, you will have diabetes. That's not the case for most people. For many people, there's a hereditary element. So First Nations peoples and people from certain ethnic backgrounds have a much higher risk of diabetes. There are autoimmune conditions, as you know. There's diabetes in pregnancy, which is quite different to other forms of diabetes. So obesity and diabetes can be linked, but they're not always linked. So it's only in a relatively small proportion, actually, that there is a link. So I was really interested, because of the stigma around diabetes and the impact on people's lives, in how to, you know, help people. Mm-hmm. So I actually applied to work with Diabetes Australia because I really wanted to immerse myself in that. It was a particular interest, and that, and I'm still there.
Yeah, well, oh, clearly. And now in a CEO role, so to go from an economist as a consultant and moving into the CEO role, that actually explains a lot in terms of that conversation we had and the way that you talked about things. I think actually at the time we were discussing your CRM, and you said you'd had experiences with a number of CRMs, and seems like I do a lot of work in that space these days. So would you mind if we talk a little tech right now? Because I feel like you're very confident in this space, to, you know, a lot of experiences in this. When you're at Diabetes Australia, with the significant growth that you just said of the people taking advantage of the scheme, like, what were you using to support that from an IT perspective?
Well, it was a very complicated system, actually, when I joined. The state and territory organisations, so this is going to sound a bit complex, but Diabetes Australia was the administrator of the scheme, and there was a national database that kept the information, you know, relating to those people who were registered with the scheme. And quite a complex database, and of course very large with that many people on it. There was also information held at state and territory level, because the state and territory diabetes organisations were agents of the scheme, so they would also collect data. So we had this kind of split system. So we, with the Commonwealth, we started moving towards more centralised databases. So we established a National Helpline Centre. Can't quite recall the year. I think it was about 2016, with a common system that interacted with the big database that I was managing. And then slowly, just recently, the state and territory databases have been merged into, essentially, their information brought into that system. It's a massive project.
Yeah, I bet.
Involving quite a number of organisations, and it's taken a couple of years to get there. But the transition, it's difficult, like any transition. You know, it's almost, you know, moving from an established way of doing things that's been around for decades, and, you know, you get all those organisational differences. Some are willing to come along and others are less willing, and managing stakeholders, but all the while working towards that end goal of, you know, having a really robust IT system.
Mm-hmm. What was the system that was decided on?
The actual technically, yeah, the system.
Is it a Salesforce? Is it Dynamics? I mean,
it's I believe it's Microsoft Dynamics. Okay. So that transition started happening. I was in the planning stages, but I wasn't in the implementation stage of that last bit.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
Yeah.
A lot of people, when they listen to these and when they talk to me, they're always interested in the tech stack of our guests. So it's always worth mentioning. It doesn't mean that they're good or bad. It just means that's who you're using.
Mm. It was Microsoft when I was there. Microsoft Dynamics was the system we were using. But the system that's being developed now is actually being developed with the government. So the government actually ran the project with the support of Diabetes Australia, this last bit, not the earlier bits.
Yeah.
So the earlier bits I was involved in, and I left sort of during the planning stages of this last bit, so exactly where it's landed.
Well, and now the organisation you're in charge of now has very different needs.
Very different, yes. Yeah. And it's a much smaller organisation as well, so it comes with challenges of its own.
How many employees?
We have around 20 employees, but they're not all full-time.
Uh-huh.
So our FTE is around 14.
Okay. Mm. And what do you keep in-house versus outsource?
We keep most things in-house. Our IT management is outsourced, and our financial role, so our financial management is outsourced, but we have quite a bit of input on both, obviously. So IT is something we're actually looking at. We're actually in the midst of an IT transformation project right at the moment, which has tied in with another very significant strategic review, which is our education pathway. We're reviewing it with a view to significantly revamping that. So we need the two in parallel because we need the IT system to support the new pathway. So it's a massive project and very important and dear to the hearts of all our members. And we really want to have it as successful as possible.
Mm. Are you adding a learning management system too?
We have a learning management system, but yes, we will be integrating that into it. And we're just introducing, as part of this revamping of our education pathway, micro-credentials as well.
Okay.
So we need systems, digital badging systems, uh-huh. and, you know, all sorts of things there as well. So this is the complexity. We're already developing micro-credentials. We actually have a big grant from the Victorian government to develop micro-credentials for the TAFE system there, diabetes micro-credentials. So we're doing that, but we don't have the new IT system. So we're sort of having a transitional arrangement before we move to a new arrangement.
Yeah.
So you can imagine we only have 14 FTE. That's including the project staff. So that's... quite a lot for a small organisation.
Yeah, for sure. Is HR in-house too?
HR is in-house, okay. Yes.
Yeah.
So we do not have a team. We have one manager who oversees finance, HR, operations.
Payroll,
everything.
That's usually the case when a poor person has all those tasks.
Yes.
Yeah. So for the IT transformation itself, there's actually a lot of membership organizations doing the exact same mm-hmm. thing right now, and especially looking at how they do certifications.
Yes.
For the micro badges, now, for people that aren't familiar with micro badges, it might be worth explaining that a little bit. They might be familiar with those on LinkedIn, where you can see a little badge that says they've taken a course or they're certified in Microsoft or something like that. Are you planning to use it any other way?
So we're planning for micro-credentials to be part of the education pathway. So we've actually developed a micro-credentialing framework.
Okay.
The reason we've done that is there's changing consumer preferences for education. So traditionally you did a uni degree, you did maybe a postgrad certificate, maybe moved on to a postgrad diploma, onto a master's, etc. People are now looking for short, sharp, I need skills in this type courses, not these great big, long, expensive, you know, types of education that we've traditionally done. So we're looking at making our pathway contemporary. So we've developed a micro-credentialing framework, which is for all health professionals. So it's tiered. So if you're a health professional who doesn't want to become a credentialed diabetes educator but needs to know or wants to know more about diabetes, there'll be micro-credentials you can do, and they're stackable, which means you could do a basic micro-credential and add to it, you know, so it creates a pathway. But we're also developing micro-credentials for credentialed diabetes educators, advanced micro-credentials to demonstrate that they're maybe an expert in diabetes technology or an expert in diabetes in pregnancy or an expert in diabetes in older people, you know, so different micro-credentials. So it's quite complex. So we've developed a framework, and associated with each micro-credential will be a digital badge. The idea of the digital badge is that they can put it on their any of their digital channels, whether it's social media or website, email. And the digital badge will be a verifiable badge, which will actually, if people click on it, it will show what's included in that. So if somebody is saying, oh, I'm not sure about that micro-credential, I've never heard of it, what is that about? They can click on it and go, it says, you know, this is what was involved in that micro-credential. So it's actually, I guess, creating transparency. And to be really frank, you know, credentialed diabetes educators, it's a tiny profession, you know, 2,500 members. So we're really trying to get people to understand what it's about. So these micro-credentials really help with that marketing and getting people to really understand diabetes education and the expertise that our members have. There's a lot of confusion that maybe nurses do diabetes care, but nurses actually do very little diabetes study in their courses. What we're trying to say here is these are highly qualified health professionals. They're not all nurses, but they are specialised in diabetes.
Are you using software that's already available, like Credly?
We're actually looking at a couple of options. So we haven't landed on the software because we need to make the decision on our new IT system. That project's underway. We're about to go to market to determine exactly which platform we'll use, and we need the two to integrate.
Yeah.
So we've got a few systems, you know, identified for all the different elements, and then we make the decision based on which ones will integrate best.
Yeah. Yeah,
so that is one that we are looking at, but there are others as well.
And the ones that I'm familiar with, I'm probably familiar with most of the membership association type CRMs that are available in Australia. They're all using a third-party platform, so it's not something that's built into the system.
No, and this is the issue for us right now. We have a very highly tailored off-the-shelf system. It is so tailored that it's becoming incredibly expensive. So, and it's getting old. So I talk about, you know, a system with Band-Aids on it that have had Band-Aids put on top of the Band-Aids, and the underlying Band-Aids are starting to fall off, which is taking the top ones off. So we're in this constant cycle of chasing our tail. So that's the reason for this project, that we just need to move to a new system. And I actually think it's a perfect time. In a way, it's been very painful dealing with this system with all these Band-Aids, but I think the timing is perfect now with this micro-credentialing and the review of our credentialing pathway to really sort of throw the cards up in the air and go, well, what's actually best practice? So we're benchmarking against other organisations, seeing what others do, and going for the best.
Mm. Well, I mean, the good thing is that most of the systems are able to integrate fairly easily with these badge type systems, and they've been around for a while now. So it's something that people are familiar with. You don't have to educate them on it. The stacking part, I think, is a little bit more complex than what you normally see, like RTOs even do. But it's starting to become more of a It's actually more important in certain career fields, especially to show more badges, isn't it?
It is. And I think for credential diabetes educators, we know there's a lack of understanding in the community. For example, Medicare funds visits to credential diabetes educators, but a lot of GPs don't seem to be aware and people don't get referred through. So this is a way of, you know, really highlighting the skills of the group. So GPs, you know, as they find out, they go, oh, actually, these are really qualified people. And it also helps a person with diabetes to select who they want to see. Because if I'm a child with type 1 diabetes, I don't necessarily want to see someone who specialises in older people with type 2 diabetes. I want to see someone who specialises in my field or my, you know, type of diabetes. So it's really important that we identify that as part of their, you know, qualification, essentially.
And I don't think enough people consider what you mentioned about it being a marketing tool as well.
Mm.
They think about it as a benefit for the members. But in reality, you're right. It is a significant marketing tool when you have LinkedIn full of these badges.
It is a marketing tool. And what I didn't mention is we have another strategy in place at the moment, which is about really driving up the quality of diabetes education for health professionals throughout Australia. So we did an audit last year of what's available, who's providing what. And what we found is there's huge variability across the country in the standards, the information, there's inconsistency, there's duplication. So what we are we're working with the other diabetes organisations to try to drive best practice, latest information, and providing the digital badges on other organisations' diabetes education. So it's not just about what we deliver. What we're trying to do is raise the standard nationally by saying to other organisations, fine, you're delivering that, meet this standard, and we will give you a micro-credential you can give your, you know, graduates of whatever course you're offering. So it's about a national approach. So I guess it's a little bit altruistic as well as being for our members. So we're trying to, you know, really raise the bar, raise awareness of diabetes, raise awareness of how it's looked after, and really improve the standard of education that all health professionals, when I say health professionals, I don't just mean health professionals, I mean care workers as well, right across the spectrum.
Given it's a health profession, maybe it's just me, but I find it interesting that it's not a proper qualification. Like, it's not actually driven by government standards at all, that it's something that is volunteer. Is that normal for other types of... Oh, it is.
Yes, okay. It is. Yes, there are a number of self-regulated professions, including in the health space. So we're not the only ones. The government has a small list of professions that they certify through ARPRA, which is a government body, but they don't want to add any more professions to that list. So we're one of those that's in the self-regulated category.
Yeah. So the ones I'm thinking about that would be already in there would be doctors,
yes,
nurses,
yes,
vets in the health profession at least.
Yeah, and there are some allied health professionals, chiropractors, for example.
Yeah.
But there are many that aren't. So dietitians aren't, exercise physiologists aren't. There's a range of professions that are self-regulated.
Yeah, okay.
So there is actually an association of self-regulated health professional organizations, believe it or not.
Well, they need support too, I suppose, right? So you just said that you have a big transformation program going on. You have some strategies and things that you're working on. Is there anything else you want to share? It just sounds like there's a lot going on with such a small team.
Yeah, it is a lot. They're really our main focuses. So we've, I guess like every organisation, you know, we strategically plan, and I've been in this role for 4 years, almost 4 years now. So my focus was actually getting the foundations right, because some things had been in place for a long time and not revisited. So it was a case of, well, okay, this is what we've got. What do our stakeholders say we're missing? You know, what aren't we doing that we should be doing, or communicating or marketing or, you know, everything? So our first focus was, when I started, was on getting some of those foundations in place, which was great. It really formed the basis of what we're doing now. So we looked at how well are we promoting the need for diabetes education, who understands the message. We found there was a huge gap with GPs. I heard some really sad stories about, you know, people having diabetes for 8 or 10 years and they hadn't been referred for diabetes education, and they developed complications. And they were, when they found out they could have had help earlier and probably avoided those complications, it's quite devastating, because the complications of diabetes are quite nasty. So I heard some really sad stories, and so we realised we had to, you know, really raise awareness of health professionals generally around the importance of people getting diabetes education right up front. Don't wait till they've got complications. Let's prevent the complications would be a much better approach. So getting consensus about, well, what is needed. So we worked with other health professionals to say, well, at exactly what points do people need diabetes education? So we mapped it all out, and we've shared that. We've been promoting that. So that was one of the foundational pieces of work we did. And the other one was to really look at, do 360-degree stakeholder consultation on our education pathways, because that's a fundamental core function of our organisation, is to provide education to our members and other health professionals. So we did a 360-degree review, which has driven this transformational project to revise our educational pathways. So I guess that's where we started. It's going to be a journey for a while. I anticipate it's probably going to be another year or two before we get our IT systems in and functioning and bedded down, but doesn't mean we're waiting till then. We're still making change all the time. So it'll be a phasing in as we can of all of the different elements.
With smaller associations, I find one of the most challenging things is budget, especially when you're doing this much change.
Yes.
So how are you funded?
We're funded, we are funded through member fees, but we also receive funding from a range of other things. So providing education, we do, I guess you could say, consultancy type education work for other organisations. So we get funds from different sources. We are also an NDSS agent. We talked about the National Diabetes Services Scheme before. We are also an agent there. I mentioned we had this large Victorian government grant, so we have a range of funding sources. We don't want to impose too much in the way of costs on our members, so we very much balance. We did an audit about a year after I started, to see how much of our costs related to member services, and was our member fee covering it? Was it not covering it? Was it too low or was it too high? We found out we're pretty right.
Okay.
So we know that our member fee pretty much covers our member services, and our other funding sources cover other things we do. So that was good. That was very reassuring. But our board has a philosophy, which I think is right as a member organisation, that strategic projects can be funded from reserves. So the board's decision in our last budget cycle was that these transformational projects aren't funded from operating costs, they're funded from reserves. And I think this is sometimes a tension between management and the board, you know, about dipping into reserves, and you can't spend reserves. But on the other hand, it's members' money. Why are you accumulating it if it is not to benefit the members? So I'm fortunate that I have a board that understands that. And so we have, you know, good reserves, and we're using those reserves to fund this. Of course, we need to replenish those reserves as well. We can't just keep dipping into them, because we all know, you know, during COVID, the financial pressures with, you know, not being able to hold conferences and events, that had a big impact on us, actually. We were running deficits for a couple of years, fairly substantial deficits, not as big as many others, though. But it's really important we have those reserves, but we also need to be investing in our members.
So you have 2,500 members now. Do you see it growing a lot or a little? Or?
Yeah. So we did a review with the another diabetes health professional peak body, which is actually the peak body for endocrinologists, the diabetes specialists. So we did a joint review of the workforce and what does it look like, you know, in terms of age and, you know, various profiles, sort of aspects of the workforce, and how big should it be? And the review actually indicated that it needs to be double the size that it is now to adequately service people with diabetes. So we've, you know, obviously we've devised our strategy. We've just developed a new strategy for the next 3 years, and that is about really getting people in and getting them in younger into the profession, so they're in the profession longer and building that expertise. So, yeah, we do need to grow significantly.
And you did talk about the growth of consumer people consuming the National Diabetes
Services Scheme, yeah.
And you also said, though, that there's a misnomer that people that get diabetes have weight issues, and that's not necessarily the case. I guess the cause and effect for the layperson out there that's not educated in this, it's really hard to say, well, you can see people increasing in weight on average over time, especially with our diets changing as we have. So is there not a direct correlation between that and diabetes? If that is the case, then it makes sense why you need so many more professionals to support this. Mm. But is that a misnomer? Do we not understand the data?
The general public, and it's quite understandable, diabetes is complex and there are different types of diabetes. So, but I think in the general public's mind, overweight and obesity mean diabetes. So if you've got diabetes, you caused it. It's a lot more complex than that. There's heredity, genetics involved, there's autoimmune issues, there's a whole range of factors that can contribute to diabetes. But I would actually say it's not overweight and obesity as such, because it's only about 20% of obese people have diabetes. So there's clearly not a direct link. It's actually our modern lifestyles. So we are becoming more sedentary. I don't know if you've heard the expression, sitting is the new smoking. So when we're not moving around, and we don't have to be going to the gym and running marathons, but when we're not, you know, taking a walk at lunchtime, we're not walking to work, we're driving door to door everywhere we go and not exercising, That is a major risk factor for diabetes. You can be thin and get diabetes. You know, if you're very, very sedentary, if you sit and watch TV for 4 hours in the evening, you're really putting yourself at high risk, even if you're not overweight. So we need to understand it's more complex. We need to build our environments and I guess our lifestyles to ensure we're exercising as well. So sedentary lifestyles are actually a major driver of diabetes. And, you know, with working from home, we know people are becoming more sedentary. We need to find other ways to deal with this. So that's what's in the public's mind, that link, but it's far more complex than that. We need to build our environments to support exercise. And then, as I said, there are the different types of diabetes. Yeah. So, you know, women are having babies at a later age. Well, that is associated with a higher risk of diabetes in pregnancy. So it's not all diet related. And that's a message it's very hard to get across in the public's mind.
Yeah, I was thinking that would also impact even your members, our potential members.
Yeah, of course.
Because they might even have this view of specialty because of that.
Yes, yes. So we are having members who are starting to specialise in various different areas. So as I said, originally the focus was on management of type 1 diabetes in hospitals. That's how the profession started. But of course, there are many people out there who have other types of diabetes. So of course, you know, it's expanded, I guess, in terms of their scope. In terms of our membership, we need to grow. Obviously, the people who already have diabetes, you can't reverse diabetes. So once you've got it, even if you manage to go into remission and hold yourself in remission for some time, it's likely that in the future you will, you know, not be in remission anymore. So we need to manage the people who have diabetes and help those who are in remission stay in remission, and try to prevent those who are at risk from getting it. That's a key factor. We'd rather they just don't get it, just manage that up front. But if they are diagnosed, even if they don't have complications or only in the early stages of diabetes, if we manage it well there, then they won't develop those complications. They won't, you know, there'll be less hospitalisations. It's a lesser cost to the health system, but they'll be healthier as well. They'll, you know, be able to live their lives to the fullest instead of being hindered by complications.
Yeah. So I could see that strategic plan being with that view in mind, that you have a lot of educating to do for the public as well. Mm-hmm. But there's, as you say, significant growth opportunities for the number of people in, as members.
Yes. I mean, we would all love to see the number fall, but we've got people who've already got diabetes. So it's going to take decades to turn that around. So we need to be taking action at the prevention end now. But in the meantime, we need a workforce to manage those who have diabetes and, you know, keep them out of hospital and help them live well so that, you know, they've got better lives and the hospital and health system has less cost.
Yeah. Mm. Well, we've already talked about a number of things and things that you did as a CEO just to put together a framework of, you know, put those foundations underneath and understanding what your members needed, those surveys and such, even getting your board on board to support the transformation cost itself. You've done a lot of work in this space just for this organization, but you clearly have had that other experience as well. Do you have any advice for other executives that may be thinking about a transformation or just at the beginning processes?
I think it's really important to do your groundwork, get your groundwork right, those foundations, really understand all the things you need to consider. You know, often when you you see an issue, you know, I need to fix that issue. But often there are related things that are also really important that you can deal with at the same time. So I think having that broad perspective, you know, going out, doing your stakeholder consultation, talking to people, I found that the most valuable thing. In my first sort of 6 months, I talked to a lot of people who maybe you wouldn't have even thought of as stakeholders, you know, but everyone brings their own views and perspectives and, you know, it all adds to the richness of how well you understand something and then what is the best way to undertake those transformational steps. So I see it as kind of an empathetic approach, and I think empathy is sometimes used in different ways, but in the way I'm using it is about really trying to talking to people and being open to what they say, not having preconceived ideas, but taking it on board, even if it's a bit confronting, and listening, and then thinking about how does that fit into the whole.
Yeah, look, I think great advice, even for just a new CEO going into an organization. So thank you for sharing that, Susan. I'm sure somebody's going to find that very valuable. Is there anything else you want to share about the organization or anything else that you want to share with the executives listening?
Yeah, well, just while we're talking about empathy, I actually think that's critical to leadership. From a stakeholder perspective, I think it's understanding who your stakeholders are and trying to put yourself in their shoes and think, what does my organisation mean for them? So, you know, whether that's, in my case, that would be the other diabetes organisations, it'd be health professionals generally, all the peak bodies, it's government, it's people with diabetes, of course, it's our members, but really trying to put yourself in their shoes and say, well, if I was on that side, if I was that stakeholder, what would I want to see? What would I want to be getting from the organisation? I think it's really critical to understand that, but also internally. So same with staff, you know, put their hat on. And I have a few key things I go over regularly with my staff about, you know, listening to other people. If you strike an issue, we call it jumping the ladder. Don't immediately get angry or frustrated. Just check you've got your facts right, because half the time you don't. You know, so just calm down, take a deep breath and check your facts and try and be professional in the way you do that and then in the way you respond, you know. So really trying to create that, I guess, collegiality in the team as well. Mm. So there are many, I think a lot of leadership is actually really just understanding people.
Yeah, it's a big job.
It is a big job, and it's a job you never stop work. You know, you're always working on those skills. I'm actually reading a fabulous book. I can't remember the author's name at the moment, but it's about the physical, the nonverbal cues that you give people to encourage them to perform or talk or be engaged, and how you can switch that off, you know. And it's amazing. Very subtle things you can do can make a really big difference.
Although harder in a hybrid environment.
Harder, but not impossible.
Yeah.
Mm. And I still think face-to-face is so different to online. I think there's always a place for face-to-face interaction.
Well, speaking of face-to-face, we're about out of time, Susan. And I'm conscious that you probably have something else you need to do today. So if people want to know more about your organization or get in touch with you, where should we send them?
You can send them to adea.com.au. That's our website. So ADEA stands for Australian Diabetes Educators Association. They could go onto our website, and that will have our phone number and other contact details there.
Okay, good deal. Well, make sure to put it in the show notes as well.
Okay, that's great.
Susan, it's great to talk to you today. Thank you for sharing all you have. I think there's a lot of little nuggets of knowledge in this conversation that somebody's going to find a lot of value in. Thank you for also talking about your transformation, because I think there's a lot, well, I know there's a lot of organizations, especially associations, that are going through transformations right now, specifically thinking about a CRM and even badging. So thanks for sharing with that too.
Yeah, my pleasure. And thank you for inviting me on the show.
Hi, this is Tammy again. When I'm not doing podcasts, I'm helping not-for-profits with IT decisions. The question for this week's IT in Plain English segment is, what are QR codes? By now, I'm sure you're familiar with the little black and white squares you can scan with your phone to go to a website. But while many governments use it to track movement during COVID, restaurants also embrace them to provide virtual menus. Yet, did you know that QR codes, or quick response codes, were originally created in 1994 by a Japanese car manufacturer? They became more popular than standard barcode systems because they can hold more information. Now, there are two types of QR codes available, static and dynamic. The static ones are always linked to a single website address, while the dynamic ones can change. A lot of not-for-profits use QR codes to allow attendees to check into events that will link to their CRMs. I've also seen them used to provide quick information about a rescue pet available for adoption. However, if your organization is using them, ensure you're implementing cybersecurity measures such as encrypting the data in the codes and regularly monitoring any suspicious activity related to the links. Because, as with anything digital, even QR codes can be compromised by bad people. So there you have it in plain English. If you have an IT question you want answered, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn and send me a message. I just might answer it on the show. And if you liked what you've heard, please subscribe and leave me a review. To all of you executives with a cause, the world is definitely a better place because of you. Thank you for what you and your teams do every day.